Welcome to Inside the Military Mind, addressing mental health and wellness for service members, veterans, and their families. Brought to you by Family Care Center, offering behavioral health services for both children and adults, and specializing in services for military families and veterans. Family Care Center, our family, caring for your family. And now, here's your host, Daniel Schrider.
Hello, and welcome to Inside the Military Mind. Coming up in today's guest segment, I'll be having a conversation with Lori Jarvis and Damian McCabe about services provided by NAMI and UC Health. Later, I will be sharing the Homefront Military Network Resource of the Week, the American Red Cross. Our show is brought to you by the Family Care Center, the community's leading provider of outpatient behavioral health for service members, veterans, and their families. Those who have served our country deserve the best that their community can offer. When it comes to mental health and wellness, it's important for them to work with someone that they can trust and who can understand their unique challenges and needs related to mental health. Whether you are looking for individual counseling, couples counseling, or management and consultation regarding mental health medications, you will find what you need at Family Care Center. Take some time to focus on you by going to fcsprings.com and allow our family to care for you and your family. As always, it would be great to hear your feedback or thoughts about mental health and wellness for the military-affiliated population. Share them with us by dropping an email to militarymind@fccsprings.com. Today's interview segment is with Lori Jarvis and Damian McCabe. Let's get into our conversation with them and come back afterwards to talk about the Homefront Military Network Resource of the Week. Well, Lori, Damian, welcome to the show. Lori, if you don't mind starting off by telling me a little bit about yourself and how you got into working with the NAMI here in Colorado Springs.
Be happy to. Thanks for having us today, Daniel. We really appreciate this opportunity. I have been at NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, here in the Springs since as a volunteer since 2010. I took NAMI's Family to Family program, which is one of our signature education programs for family members who have a loved one with mental illness. We call it our point of entry program because there's a lot of people like me. That's how they get started with NAMI. So I volunteered for a couple years. I was between corporate gigs. I had always been in the corporate world, mostly with Fortune 500 companies in the public affairs marketing area. And I have a daughter who lives with serious mental illness, and walking in the door at NAMI was absolutely life-changing for us, for me as an individual, for us as a family, in terms of understanding what was going on. And so within a couple of years, I became the executive director. NAMI was very small, very grassroots at the time. We've been around since 1983. So we have a long history in the community, but definitely were grassroots, volunteer-driven until 2012 when I stepped into the executive director role. We have just had sort of a phenomenal growth. Our budget has grown like tenfold since those early days. I flew solo for a long time in terms of it was just me with a whole lot of volunteers. NAMI is very volunteer-driven, so we're there for people who are facing the challenges of mental illness, whether it's the onset of an illness, the first hospitalization. We're also there for families to help them understand what's going on. It can be a very isolating experience, and we know that because we've lived it. And yeah, that's kind of our stock in trade in terms of that's our value proposition, is we know what this is like. So that's how I got involved, and that's why I've stayed involved. I love the work.
Oh, man, that's incredible. Thank you. I've mentioned it in a few of the previous shows. I said working in the mental health field, it finds you. You don't find it. So that's incredible. Damian, do you mind sharing some of your backstory and where you're at today?
Yeah. So Damian McCabe, I'm a very recently retired clinical social worker from the Army. Prior to that, I served a variety of behavioral health provider roles in the military, including clinician, teacher, program manager, just a variety. My last two hooks were with operational units. So I was with the Combat Aviation Brigade over at Fort Carson. And that was my last time to Afghanistan, and I'm long in the tooth and a few other things. And so I decided time to make a transition back to the type of work I did before I joined the military. And my introduction to NAMI came when I was a young clinician just out of graduate school working towards my licensure with a hospital in rural Maine. And I was doing a lot of crisis work, emergency room work. And I routinely came across families with members of their family in crisis of some kind, most often a pretty acute mental illness episode. But as you imagine, in places like rural Maine, there's not a lot of systems around for, the management of chronic mental illness and to provide family support, respite, or even just basic education about mental illness, really how to live and support a family member with mental illness. At that time, I discovered a fledgling organization called NAMI. And at that time, really in Maine, it was two or three families. It was a very small, grassroots, peer support, peer-led organization. But what I found very quickly was they were much more capable of relating and much more able to support a family who was trying to support their own family member with chronic mental illness. And they came to be my go-to, even though they were small in number. They were huge in terms of experience. They were huge in terms of the ability to provide peer support. And they were willing to share their lived experience with mental illness with other family members. And so that just wasn't something that was around at that point. That was almost 30 years ago. The government paid for me to go on some government-sponsored sojourns around the world. And when I finished up here in Colorado, I decided to stay in Colorado and linked up with UC Health. And through a mutual colleague at UC Health, I was reintroduced to Lori and the NAMI team here in the Springs, and it just fit. And it was really like putting a glove back on again, back into that peer-led, peer-supported, family-centered approach to helping folks live with chronic mental illness to the fullest extent that they can, to really live a fulfilled life.
Man, well, that's awesome to have that experience almost 30 years ago with them, the grassroots, right, the very beginning. And then to come back on the board when it's a national organization, right?
Right. Well, and it's just so nice to have someone like Damien who understands the fundamentals of NAMI, just foundationally, mm-hmm. who we are, how we work. And then he brings such great insight into the military world, which is something we needed and really value. So that's been a gift as well.
Oh, that's great. It's awesome when things work out, right? So, Damien, can you tell me a little bit about what it's been like transitioning out of the service into your role at UC Health and then subsequently on the board with NAMI here in the Springs?
I think I'm very fortunate. I had some time to prepare for my retirement and to think about what did I want to do. And then, it's going to sound a little strange, but the pandemic dropped in 2 months after I dropped my retirement papers. And the normal retirement process, coming out of the service after 24 years is about 18 months of running around, with your tail on fire, trying to figure out what's next. But the pandemic kind of slowed everything down for me, Not a lot was open. There weren't a lot of things you could do. In that time, I got an opportunity really to think through career-wise what I wanted to do and where I wanted to do it. I didn't want to keep doing the same thing over and over, so I was looking for some alternatives. But I wanted to stay connected to the veteran community here in Colorado and specifically El Paso County. So I had been approached a little prior to my retirement by some colleagues that I'd been in the military with who now work for UC Health to consider bringing some of that knowledge base over to the UC Health system. And I work for the system, which is the statewide entity for UC Health, as opposed to one of the specific clinics. And UC Health had made a commitment almost around the same time, around 2019, to invest $100 million into expanding access to behavioral health services in the state of Colorado. And of that, there was another $25 million that they would match into the regions for innovative behavioral health programming. Within that domain, there was a specific interest or carve-out, if you will, to expand services for veterans and veterans' family members. So you could call it star alignment, best laid plans, preparation of the battle space, whatever you want to go with. My timing was right and to become part of an organization that was looking to expand its service footprint for veterans and their family members, specifically within the domain of behavioral health. So that's how I ended up. But you see how since landing there, it's been pretty much go, go, go. Every few weeks, another initiative comes around and somebody comes along and asks, you know, we have that here? Yes, we do. How do we get some of that? And that isn't always very well defined. Mm-hmm. And so we've had great opportunities to speak with folks and work through things like integrated counseling or integrated behavioral health support to chronic diseases or cardiac care or pulmonary rehab or rehab medicine. I think in the most recent period of conflict, folks have they've kind of forgotten that our veterans, our veteran population is across the lifespan. So it's not just that group. They probably now, 30 to 50, the folks that joined up after 9/11 and are retiring out. But we have a whole, you know, posse of veterans that were in the first Gulf War, in Kosovo, in the Baltics, across that period of time. We still have, you know, quite a few Vietnam veterans in our community and Korean veterans in our community. And their medical and healthcare needs are very difficult to extricate from their behavioral health and counseling needs. So as they deal with terminal illness or chronic illness or trauma related from their previous service, our primary care locations are starting to see more and more folks with a need for behavioral health that we just hadn't really anticipated before. Mm-hmm. So we've had opportunities to work in those domains and have folks begin a conversation around what does integrated behavioral health care look like for veterans. Addition to that, there is a particularly negative data point here in El Paso County around veteran suicide. And UC Health really wanted to have some effort in place where we could look at that data, look at the incidence of suicide, try to understand it as best we could, and then align a service to that. And the area that we identified was that a transitioning soldier who, or transitioning airman or marine or sailor, who's coming to the community having lived most of their adult life in a more regimented and institutionalized manner, you know, prescriptive schedules and expectations. And now they're into the civilian community where they're in charge for the first time. They've got a plan for themselves, their families, for careers, for education, all of that. And it can be pretty overwhelming. But it also can be a point in time where other demands of transition come back to make it more difficult. So if they've been shoving down stress or anxiety or depression or, you know, trauma-related exposures for years while they were in the service, there's not a sort of institutional demand to do that anymore. And so it's more difficult to kind of keep that in place. So our point of entry here was to look at that population, figure out what makes transition helpful, figure out what makes transition not helpful, and to put some programs in place to bridge into those areas where we think that there's more stress, more likelihood of crisis. You know, the data, pretty much better data these days on suicidality than we've ever had. But we know that it's often an impulsive decision at a crisis point in someone's life. And we can list the number of crisis points that come with transition. And our goal was really to put something in place where we can get people through those crisis points. And maybe that's all they are, crisis points, and they go on and have a, you know, fulfilled life. Or maybe the crisis points illuminate something that's more chronic, a PTS-related situation, or maybe a chronic depression, or maybe a grieving or moral injury circumstance that's more difficult to work with. So I lead that effort in trying to understand that and develop those programs and implement them to put them in place so that our veterans and service members in the region can take advantage of them.
Well, that is incredible. Quite an initiative, or I should say several initiatives, right? I mean, you guys are really trying to take the scope of the whole gambit, not only just the transitioning military, but the generations that have come out of the military, and addressing those kind of on their individual needs, right? There are common threads, but there's unique scenarios to each one of those generations.
Yeah, that's absolutely the way to characterize it, Daniel, is that there's this, Laurie's heard me say this a number of times, but there's this monolithic interpretation of the military or the veteran. And we're as responsible in healthcare for, you know, continuing or fueling that monolithic impression. But I think when we start to think about the individual need basis, you know, so if I'm a Vietnam veteran and I've had my second or third heart attack and I've been in and out of the system and I'm starting to have a more regular occurrence of sort of mortality salience, you know, what's my life worth? When's the next time it's going to happen? You know, what if I die tomorrow? We have an individual need amongst a large healthcare problem. So when we think about cardiac health, well, that's a pretty common healthcare problem. But then we get into the individual need that's potentially informed by that veteran's experience back in Vietnam or how they've lived their life since that period. And it manifests itself in longer courses of care or longer stays in the hospital. And sometimes it manifests in not making progress. And docs are kind of scratching their heads and wondering, we're doing everything. Why is this person not making progress? They're not dialed in to think, well, maybe there's some underlying depression that's situational to this circumstance in life. Maybe there's an anxiety. You know, maybe they're not sleeping at night because they're worried they're not going to wake up the next morning. And so they're not following their treatment plan. Well, if you don't follow your treatment plan, progress doesn't occur, right? You know, the body will heal naturally, but perhaps not in the time frame that docs expected. So we're helping the docs develop that that lens to look holistically, and not that trite sort of holistic understanding of, you know, medicine, but an integrated, holistic, whole person's experience in life, with a key element of considering the fact that you're working with a veteran or you're working with an active duty member or the family of an active duty member or veteran, and try to understand the layers that that brings. And then if you need us to come help, we're happy to do that. We have one of our programs, the pulmonary rehab program, are actually considering hiring a clinician into their service line to help all their patients with behavioral health components. But I think, you know, we've kind of started that conversation for them with the veteran's perspective. But again, it's a need that crosses, you know, all of the community.
Yeah, that's incredible. I really appreciate that. If you're just joining the show, you're listening to Inside the Military Mind with your host, Daniel Schreider. Today, I'm having a conversation with Laurie Jarvis, Executive Director of NAMI here in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and Damian McCabe, Director of Behavioral Health Military Affairs for UC Health and board member of NAMI. So, yeah, that's incredible. I mean, I hear what you're saying about embedding the holistic approach and the behavioral health, even with your cardiac. And it just kind of sparked a thought for me, like that's what they've been trying to do in the military is embed behavioral health into the unit. So everybody's trying to break down this stigma, right? And I keep going back to, I'm like, physical injuries, we address them, right? I break my leg, I go to the doctor. I got a hurt heart or a hurt mind. I'll hold off for a while, and I don't want to be seen getting help like that. And that's one of the point of the show and bringing you guys on. I just appreciate your insight and your wealth of knowledge in that. So with all these insights, I was wondering if you'd share some of the fund gathering process of getting all these things going together and some of the fundraising projects that you guys have been working on.
I think most recently, well, I would obviously give Laurie some big props here because Laurie has made a very deliberate effort to craft a board of directors for NAMI locally that reflects the community that is El Paso County. So, you know, I have a voice that represents a perspective in terms of military healthcare, behavioral health provider, suicide prevention, you know, sort of operational stressors on individual service members, veterans, and their families. But we also have parents who have lived with adolescents and children who deal with chronic mental illness all the time, or maybe had a catastrophic mental illness circumstance, and the family members moved through that and is doing well. But that experience has lent them the knowledge and skill to provide support to other families. And our board comes from across the spectrum. You know, we have physicians, accountants, practice managers, business folks, lawyers. I was saving that one. We do have the coroner, but I would say this, and our coroner is hilarious. So, Leon, if you're listening, get some more funky sneakers, man. Our coroner has really made it a point to bring to our community's attention the unfortunate consequence of suicide as his office is involved. And so that high level of suicide in El Paso County is not limited to just the veterans, right? So my last tour in Afghanistan, I think one of the crappiest emails I had to write to my brigade commander was sort of a heads up, ma'am, I need to tell you what's going on in El Paso County. And in one of our school districts, we had three pretty much back-to-back adolescent suicides. It happened to be a school district my kids were in. So I had sort of a visceral reaction to that. But also knew in my role as the the aviation brigade's advisor to the commander in terms of all things, behavioral and psychosocial wellness, I need to give her a heads up because all the other parents deployed with us were about to start getting the same emails and messages. And so it was going to become a conversation point. Our coroner really has helped the community understand that when these things happen, we have to come together as a community. It has to be a whole of community response. And that was 15, 16, or spring 16 into 17, I think, that's if right. I remember. Forgive me, my memory's a little dodgy in that time. I can't remember. I know where I was, but I don't remember all the days.
Those days tend to bleed together.
Yeah, they do. It started in, I think that deployment started in November, and the next morning was like October the next year, and I came home. We did have a whole community response. We did turn that number around. We did get good peer support, good clinical information and education into the school districts. Is it still a concern? Absolutely. I think it'll always be a concern. And even more so, I think it'll be a concern for military families and their children, because there is a second sort of cultural element and isolation that happens for military adolescents. But I think we do have a good team in place to keep that conversation going, put the initiatives in place. The initiatives cost money. We have to have resources to do that. And our board represents, I think, a good spectrum of our community, be able to reach into our community and advocate for support. I throw it over to Lori to talk about our recent, very successful effort.
We just did a walk, NAMI Walks, on October 9th and raised close to $150,000 with that walk. So we just enjoy incredible support from the community. I mean, GE Johnson Construction Company was one of our major sponsors, along with UC Health. So they were our presenting sponsors. So I think what I'd like to say is, we have known at NAMI for a long time that we needed to do a better job of reaching into the military community. I have a personal passion for that community. I grew up as a military dependent. I'm a daughter of one of those Vietnam War era guys who, believe me, they did not have integrated care.
No, they did not.
There was no blending of behavioral health and physical health in their days. And so so I watched and saw and experienced so all of the implications of having a father who was based in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War for long periods. He was flying reconnaissance missions in Southeast Asia with the Air Force. And so, I've wanted to do something, and it's been a passion of mine since I came to NAMI. But what we've discovered over the years, what I've discovered is the partner, the family member may reach out about their active duty family member, but they are so reluctant to seek service if they're still active duty. That whole notion of combat ready or fitness for duty is so ingrained into the military culture. And I know you know, I know of what I speak in terms of, you know, when you grow up in that environment, you know what that looks like and feels like, and you understand people's hesitation about being transparent about what's really going on with their family member who's maybe been deployed multiple times and is not doing well. So I would say there's been a gap for us in really being able to address what we know is, I mean, this is a big part of our community here in the Springs, and we want to do better. And having someone like Damien on board with the kind of insight that he has and, you know, just his years of military experience in addition to his current role with UC Health, I think is going to give us so much more to work with in terms of our own programming, how we really leverage NAMI's peer model. Because, I mean, if there was ever a peer culture, it is the military, I think, you know. And so there should be a receptivity to this peer support. But you really, I think, have to have a different level of understanding than we've been able to achieve so far, or just maybe the right connections, the right partnerships. And so those are the things with Damien's help, I think we're going to be able to do a much better job of. And, you know, we cannot ignore the suicidality that's going on in both our veteran and our active duty community and among family members. I mean, Damien mentioned the concern about, you know, the suicides up north. There was a lot of affiliation in those schools in the northern part of the county with the military. A lot of those kids are, you know, high-achieving, driven kids who, you know, have that military model out in front of them all the time of, you know, excellence, achievement. And then you add into that a parent who's absent for an important developmental period in adolescence or pre-adolescence. And so those are the kinds of issues that we are keenly aware of, but have, I think, fallen short in terms of really delivering programs that can appeal to and serve military families and active duty and veterans. So we're hoping that'll change pretty quickly here. In terms of fundraising, we have done very, very well in this community, and I think we'll even do all the better as we shift gears and focus a little bit more on the veterans community. This community, so many of us have military ties and military roots, even if they're not, you know, sort of active right now. We can reach back into our past and go, yep, that's definitely a part of my experience. So, I remember when I told my dad that I was looking at moving to Colorado Springs, and I said, I don't think I'm going to like it very much. He goes, oh, you are going to like it. And he reminded me that he had coordinated the flyover for the Air Force Academy graduation when Kennedy spoke. I mean, that's how long, you know, his sort of career goes back. But yeah, so that's a long time ago, but it doesn't mean that I don't still have a lot of appreciation for what families and active duty and veterans are experiencing.
I think, you know, there's something in there that I'd like to pick up on, Lori, and it's something that we, you know, as troops kind of hold very precious in this idea of the peer system and you know, identifying that the military is a peer organization, and we are. And within that institution, we have this concept of the battle buddy, and for lots of reasons, right? So if you're brand new off the bus to basic, your battle buddy is the one that's going to keep you out of trouble. And if you don't stay out of trouble, your battle buddy gets, you know, held responsible for you.
That's right.
I could use some other words, but it's radio. But as you move through your career and you develop other battle buddies, and you build and rely upon these battle buddy relationships, they really are peer support relationships. They've been commercialized in movies and things like that, but at the heart of them, I can tell you the names of the people, where they live, what they did for me, what I did for them, and if I needed something tomorrow, who I would call. And I know they would be there. And so one of the pieces, and Daniel, I'm sure you can relate to this, but one of the pieces within our community here is to help translate NAMI's peer model into the lexicon of the military, the lexicon of the veteran, to view it as an extension of the battle buddy concept. And, you know, you'll hear it often that, you know, people will ask, well, why do people fight? And often you'll hear the answer, well, I fight for the person to the left and to the right. And at the moment, at the time, and it doesn't matter if you're actively engaged in fighting or you're struggling to make PT, there's somebody on your left and right that's going to cover you or is going to get you through that. And in the event that something happens to you, they're going to pick you up and they're going to get you back where you need to be. And I think our ability, my ability on the board, but our ability as a whole board, and now, I mean, there's three veterans on there now, and maybe another one joining us, is to help that translation, to help the team, the volunteer team, to increase or evolve their capacity to really understand the military culture, to come to a competency level in working with military veterans and families. You know, we use the term military cultural competency in the field, if you will, but it's generally in the field only speaking to other veterans or military people. I don't think a lot of other people consider it that way. But I think that's a piece where we can bring to, and we want to bring from the board down into the organization, and then propagate that through the community. You know, our older veterans are incredibly touched when a younger veteran recognizes them or does something very small. But I think it's that the reflection of that battle buddy concept, that little bit of emotion that you don't know the person, but there's a relation piece. And it's powerful. It's hugely powerful.
I've seen it over and over again, you know, with my, just even with, seen it over and over again, even with my dad, you know, just we'd stay at military facilities, Bethesda or whatever, and go, where's dad? Well, he's downstairs having coffee with guys he doesn't even know, but he does know. You know, so, you know, you'd get up early to go down and meet with the guys who were convalescing there, you know, at the hospital. So he has never stepped away from that. He's 89 years old. He's never stepped away from that. So, yeah, I'm glad you raised that point.
Yeah, well, before we go any further, I want to thank both of you for your service. I mean, all these years, both in the military and the community, it's incredible. And I happen to live through that myself, you know, that military concept when you get out, you're like, okay, well, that's over, right? Like, I got out and I was like, all right, see you guys later. And like, I'm going back home. And I didn't really stay in touch with a lot of my military friends. Even leaving, I was a dual service, so I did some time in the Marines. I got out for a little bit, decided, hey, this is really tough. I'm going to jump back in the military because I liked it. We'll go with the Army this time and stay in for the long haul. And my story ended up getting cut short, but that's another story for another time. But both those transitions, when I left, I was like, okay, well, that's it. It happened to be in my darkest hour that Marines from my original unit reached out and said, what are you doing? Like, wake up. Look at your family. Look at what you're doing. I don't know how to help you, but I'm telling you to wake up. And at the time, you know, I was a little aggressive towards them. And like you said, we're on radio, so we'll keep it edited. But I called them back later and I thanked them. And that battle buddy concept, the power of relationship, you know, I think that sometimes we in our culture get wrapped up in technology and processes and all these things. And man, sitting down having a cup of coffee with somebody can literally change their life.
Yeah. Daniel, you're hitting it on the head. We are hoping to create a perception, at least amongst the veteran community, that is an absolute asset, given to them, developed in the military. It's a lifetime asset. It doesn't, you know, we can say, see ya, take the uniform off. That doesn't go away. And there's a very visceral experience when you feel it. And sometimes your buddies don't want to receive, or sometimes they don't want to hear the help that's necessary.
Right. Yeah.
But just like in service, if you suck on the range one day, well, there's going to be another day on the range.
Yep.
And another day on the range. And those same battle buddies will be there when that happens. And so we hope to capitalize on that concept as we roll out additional services, both in my role as a board member at NAMI, but also as we expand, you know, UC Health's initiative to reach as many folks through any of the UC Healthcare points of entry. So it really doesn't matter if it's radiology or your primary care doctor or you're just in for the shock clinic, we hope to be able to connect and ignite that process where folks are acknowledging, not in that thank you for your service acknowledgement kind of way, but acknowledging that your service has given you some tools or maybe some challenges that affects your entirety of your ability to live a fulfilled life. And we want to be a part of helping resolve that. So
yeah. And I think your guys' role in this and educating them and seeing the transition process, I've talked to a few soldiers that have gotten out recently, and I thought, wow, look at how much has changed since I got out in 2012 for the positive.
Just in terms of the kind of
the
support.
The education, yes, yeah. The support, the programs that are there. Like I said, mine was abrupt, so I was kind of out quick. But yeah, we're moving away from checking the block. You know, we're not just saying, hey, we gave them a piece of paper on it. We're sitting down and we're engaging those soldiers as they transition. And to your point, I mean, I got out, I was a trigger puller. I was infantry in the Marines. I was infantry and then eventually an 18 Bravo. So I was always the gun guy. And I got out and it took several of my friends and mentors and people in the VA over time saying, hey, man, you got a lot of life skills in the military. I'm like, no, I'm a trigger puller. I'm like, no, man, there's so much more to what you do. Communication skills, right. Teamwork, engagement, watching, seeing a need and filling a need in the community. I mean, that is stuff that's inherent to us,
yeah.
Right? And helping those guys to see that I do still have value in the world. Yeah. And then they start engaging and they realize that those skills very much transfer in the world and the world needs it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, kind of a coincidental point, but my team right now, the folks I work with every day, I have a combat engineer turned, you know, gun bunny, went off and did infantry engineering. You know, met an IED, didn't like, and, you know, ended his time in the service early and has gone through that same journey. What do I do with this? And he's now back on my team as a clinical social worker. And I have a former Marine trigger puller who did almost the same journey as you, got out, came back in the Army. He's a 15 Tango with the medevac unit. And he is now finishing up his final year to become a clinical social worker. So absolutely those assets, whether they're the, you know, in the community, often refer to them as soft skills, right, or soft assets. Whether they are those organizational hard skills or those soft relational skills or just the ability to be empathic at the right time with the right person in the right place, you can't undersell them at all. And I think that's one of those things that we will be able to look to our veterans community in terms of peer support and developing formal peer support is that they still have it. And we're going to ask them to, hey, bring some of that back and help your brothers and sisters.
Yeah. And in the other part, you guys mentioned working with the coroner, and I've heard him mention a few other circles, so he must be a pretty good guy to get a funny guy to get along with. But
he's not what you would expect from your local coroner.
Well, I can't wait
refreshing.
To meet him.
He's refreshing on that front.
But he's passionate about the suicide here in El Paso County. And I think with UC Health coming along and NAMI and everybody working together, we start to create the data set. Right, required to back up the stuff that we're doing, right? Grassroots. A lot of times the biggest struggle with grassroots is we're legitimately doing work here and people are like, and like I said, our day and age, show me the data. Show me that graph.
Is it evidence-based? You know, how do you quantify this?
Right?
Yeah, how do you quantify your results?
And you're
results?
Going, it's working, I promise. But I think that'll happen
over time. I heard recently an epidemiologist tell a story that the, you know, the kid was so into data and, you know, everything had to be backed up with, you know, numbers that his mom came in one day and said, I love you. And he said, yeah, show me the data on that. So
that's a good snapshot of the world.
Really. Yeah, it's kind of like, but you're absolutely right, Dan. We work in an intangible field when we start out. We get smart about how do we measure this stuff? How do we collect this data? How do we know we're making a difference in people's lives? And we have now technology and collateral professions that want to help us do that. And we have to be open to that when that opportunity presents itself, where we can make data-driven decisions, where we can use evidence-informed processes to improve the way we deliver services and ultimately improve people's lives.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And we may have started out grassroots, and we certainly did, but we've gotten a lot smarter about evaluation. We know now how to evaluate the work that we're doing because we need to. I mean, our funders ask for it, and we can do it now. So.
Yeah, so, and I was just about to ask that very same question. So since the 1970s, can you give me a snapshot of the history and kind of how we've gotten to where we are today with NAMI?
So NAMI really came out of the movement to deinstitutionalize those who were in long-term state hospital, long-term care facilities, those with persistent serious mental illness. So there was a movement to return many of those people who had lived a good part of their lives in these institutions away from their families. There's a movement to send them back to the community, to their families. And so these families welcomed home people that they may not have lived with, family members they may not have lived with because they had illnesses they didn't understand. Part of the reason that was possible was because the improvements in medications. When we look at those medications now, things like Thorazine and stuff, we would go, that was an improvement. But it was. It
right.
was then.
Absolutely.
It was then. So they could actually, right. you know, not be institutionalized, be back into a family home setting, be back in the community. What didn't happen were the community resources to really support these individuals and families. And so that's where NAMI stepped in. And so that's the kind of the birth of the NAMI movement, the genesis for it. And we, I would say at our core, we still do a lot of that type of work with families. Our mission is to educate, support, and advocate. So we have weekly support groups for everyone from someone living with a mental illness to a family member who has a loved one that's struggling to a parent who has a younger child. So those go on weekly. We do all kinds of education programs that help people understand mental illness, the medications, the treatments. And there's a whole element of taking care of yourself when you're a caregiver for someone who has a serious illness.
Absolutely.
So we do a lot of work around that for people too. We're based in Southeast Colorado Springs now, actually at the Silver Key facility, if you happen to be familiar with where they're located. We're at 1615 South Murray. Our phone number is 719-473-8477. And our website, if you want to learn more about NAMI Colorado Springs, is NAMI, N-A-M-I, ColoradoSprings.org. We're open 9 to 5 every day. We have a wonderful library that's located at the office. No charge, no late fees. We'd love for you to return the books. Most do. Kind of an honor system. But we're there and we take phone calls, what we call our resource and referral calls. So we have what we call a warm line. We get phone calls daily from people who are trying to navigate the behavioral health care system in our community. It's not easy. A lot of times people end up with loved ones with serious illness who are in criminal justice involved. So we do a lot of work. We do a lot of work with the jail when someone needs to be receiving treatment, medication, and they're not. So those are the kinds of things we kind of do day in and day out, along with the education and support. That's advocacy sort of takes that role. We take that role of advocating for individuals who are not getting what they need in the system. So I've been doing it long enough that I know, you know, I have wonderful colleagues at all of the psych hospitals here in town and most of the providers. So, you know, we have this sort of ad hoc support that we offer people when they really are not getting what they need. And part of that is just the journey of learning how to get what you need.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
well, thank you for all that information, and hopefully everyone caught how to get a hold of you. If you're just joining the show, you're listening to Inside the Military Mind with your host, Daniel Schreider. And today, I'm having a conversation with Lori Jarvis, Executive Director of NAMI here in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and Damian McCabe, Director of Behavioral Health, Military Affairs for UC Health, and the board member of NAMI. So earlier, we were talking about the community, right? And you just touched on it, even how to get a hold of you guys, all the different places that people can go to, and it's going to end up back at you guys, right? That you guys are working together with all these other units. So You talked about a concept of value added. Can you expand on that?
Sure. Well, I think it's one of the things that's come out of COVID for us at NAMI. We, for years, obviously for decades, we have been there for families who are facing fairly serious mental illness, whether it's bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, treatment-resistant depression, things that really can be life-altering for folks. And what we've discovered and what we're really being called upon to do since the pandemic is really help the broader community address some of the mental health issues associated with this, you know, worldwide pandemic. It's significant. We have we've adapted to it. We've integrated it into our lives, but it doesn't mean that it hasn't taken its toll on many of us. So there are people who have never experienced any kind of mental health symptom that are really struggling now from the isolation, the grief, the sense of loss, whether they've lost a loved one, whether they've lost a job, whether they just have lost routine. Our older adults were extremely isolated. Those who were living in assisted living facilities lost the ability to have their family members come in. We can talk about every demographic in our community being affected, whether it's young kids, teens, older adults, parents, young parents who had to take on homeschooling their kids, online learning. So what we're really trying to do is help people understand that the kind of support that we offer has a universality to it. You don't have to have a serious, persistent mental illness to benefit from the kind of peer support. When you get into a room, or whether it's a virtual room or a face-to-face experience, and we're doing both groups at this point, in person and online, you realize that, we are empathetic beings, and you get into a room and there's going to be someone in that room that's going to identify what's going on for you, and maybe even have some thoughts about how they handled their own experience with anxiety or insomnia related to COVID. And I think what's starting to happen as we see people coming to our groups that, are really, dealing with situational mental health issues related to the pandemic, they're developing a greater insight into what it's like to live with maybe more challenging mental health conditions, behavioral health conditions, such as some of these more serious mental illnesses that I talked about. So it's been a really interesting phenomenon to start to make this shift into the broader community. And, we're being called upon because I think the peer model is seen as people understand its impact and how successful it can be. It's life-changing when you walk into a setting where not only are you free to talk about what's actually, truly, really going on in an authentic way, but you also are going to hear from people and get support from people who have walked this journey, who really can be genuinely helpful. In so many cases, it's that person who lives with the illness or that family member who has a family member with mental illness. There's so much credibility, so much more so even than from a provider. I'm going to listen to you probably over my psychiatrist or my therapist if I know that you really get what I'm going through right now, whether it's a medication change that I'm going through and the symptoms I'm experiencing, and you've had those same kinds of symptoms, there's huge credibility and huge education in that for people. So that's what we're working hard to do, is making sure that we can keep that model going, strengthen it, expand it, make it just very available to whomever needs it. And there's communities that we're trying to get into, the veterans, the military community is one of those. But we also have not done a great job historically of getting into communities of color. So we're working very hard to make that transition and to expand our services. And we're discovering that really meaningful partnerships make all the difference in the world. Right. We don't have to invent the wheel. There are already organizations that have relationships in these communities and are trusted partners in these communities. So that's what we're trying to do, whether it's partnering with Silver Key to reach the older adult community, whether it's partnering with a military organization, with Centro de la Familia to reach the Spanish-speaking community. Those are the kinds of things we're trying to pursue now so that we do have a broader and deeper reach.
Yeah, that's incredible. And with the peer support, the peer model that you guys are doing, you're right. Everywhere you go, it's going to work because it's about connection and relationship and understanding one another.
Well, and I hate to bring it back to money, but it's a driver in our lives, right? And it's such a cost-effective model. We have 140 volunteers at NAMI. They volunteer their time to do this work. They get specialized training to do it. They want to give back. They have... they may be stable now after a long period of illness, or they may have a family member who has gone through a lot of, a lot of experiences, a lot of treatments, hospitalizations. They want others. They want to help others because they know how challenging it was for them to go navigate this by themselves. They don't want others to have to do it this way.
Yeah. So. Well, that's incredible. I thank you for your time today and the stories that you shared, and obviously, it works, right? Since the 1970s, the grassroots, and now nationwide, we're replicating the model, and we're taking it in more and more different cultures. We're breaking down barriers, and we're getting people to heal by spending time with one another. So, Damien, Lori, thank you for joining me today. I really appreciated it.
Thank you. Really appreciate it, Daniel.
I hope you appreciated my conversation with Lori and Damien. We'd love to hear your thoughts. If you drop us an email at militarymind@fccsprings.com. Next, I'd like to introduce this week's Homefront Military Network Partner of the Week, the American Red Cross. The American Red Cross prevents and alleviates human suffering in the face of emergencies by mobilizing the power of volunteers and the generosity of donors. The American Red Cross, through its strong network of volunteers, donors, and partners, is always there in times of need. They aspire to turn compassion into action so that all people affected by disaster across the country and around the world receive care, shelter, and hope, so that communities are ready and prepared for disasters, so that everyone in our country has access to safe, life-saving blood and blood products, so all members of our armed services and their families find support and comfort wherever needed. During emergencies, there are always trained individuals nearby ready to use their Red Cross skills to save lives. Since their founding by Clara Barton on May 21, 1881, the American Red Cross has been dedicated to serving people in need. They received their first congressional charter in the year 1900, and to this day, they are tasked by the federal government with providing services to members of the American Armed Forces and their families, as well as providing disaster relief for the United States and around the world. In 2021, the Red Cross celebrated 140 years of compassionate service. Even while the Red Cross adapts to meet the changing needs of the people they serve, they always stay true to their roots. Are you familiar with the classic images of the Red Cross nurses helping American soldiers and civilian war victims during World War I? In fact, as you're listening to this, Red Cross staff and volunteers are still deploying alongside America's military. Maybe you've taken a class through the Red Cross, such as a first aid certification or how to swim. Did you know that the Red Cross has been offering similar training since the early 1900s? Have you ever given blood or received donated blood? The Red Cross developed the first nationwide civilian blood program in the 1940s, and they still provide more than 40% of the blood products in this country. Today, as throughout their long history, the Red Cross depends on generous contributions of time, blood, and money from the American public to support their life-saving services and programs. Alongside disaster relief, blood drives, and training/certification courses, the American Red Cross helps the members of the military, veterans, and their families prepare for, cope with, and respond to the challenges of military service. The Red Cross has served more than 1 million military families since 9/11. Volunteers provide home comforts and critical services on bases and in military hospitals around the world. They support military families during deployments and emergencies. They continue serving our nation's veterans after their service ends. Every day, the American Red Cross provides 24/7 global emergency communication services and other support in military and veteran health care facilities across the country and around the world. You can initiate a request for Red Cross emergency assistance for family members of the military currently serving in active duty by using the online self-service tool. The American Red Cross does not authorize emergency leave for members of the United States military. The Red Cross's role is to independently verify the emergency, enabling the service member's commander to make an educated decision regarding emergency leave and then to provide transportation assistance and or financial assistance if needed. To speak to the Red Cross Emergency Communication Specialist, call 1-877-272-7337. The American Red Cross works in partnership with military aid societies to provide quality, reliable financial assistance to eligible applicants 24/7, 365 days a year. Assistance can include funds for emergency travel, burial of loved ones, or emergency food and shelter. Call the American Red Cross Hero Care Center at 1-877-272-7337. If you are an active duty service member, a member of an activated National Guard or Reserve unit, an immediate family member of a service member in the above two categories, a military retiree or spouse, or retiree. When calling the Red Cross, please provide as much of the following information about the service member that is known: full legal name, rank or rating, branch of service, social security number, date of birth, military unit address, information about the deployed unit and home base unit. For deployed service members. Whether your family is facing its first deployment or the next of many, the American Red Cross has developed workshops, information, and support services to help you with the practical and emotional challenges. These services include coping with deployment courses, pre-deployment preparedness, tools for family members, reconnecting workshops, mind-body workshops, and post-deployment support resources. The American Red Cross offers confidential services to all veterans and their families by connecting them with local, state, and national resources through their network of chapters in communities across the United States and offices on military installations worldwide. Local Red Cross offices develop and maintain relationships with key community partners. Veterans and their families rely on the Red Cross to help them identify their needs and connect them to the most appropriate resource. These vital services range from responding to emergency needs for food, clothing, and shelter, referrals to counseling services, information on veteran cemeteries or burial benefits, and other resources that meet the unique needs of local veterans and their families. The Red Cross assists veterans and their families in preparing, developing, and obtaining sufficient evidence to support applicants' claims for veteran benefits. They also assist claimants seeking to appeal the Board of Veterans Appeals, BVA. This work is done by the Red Cross staff at the BVA, as well as a network of state work share representatives who are accredited by the Department of Veterans Affairs to work on behalf of the Red Cross. Red Cross volunteers serve in veteran administrations and military hospitals across the nation and around the world. Volunteers, which include many veterans and their families, provide vital assistance in the areas of rehabilitation, recreation, administration, and personal services to the men and women who answered the country's call and who are now cared for each day in the military hospitals and VA medical centers. For more information and assistance, veterans and their families should contact their local Red Cross office. Red Cross also offers military and veteran care networks for peers to exchange experience, empathy, education, and encouragement. Caregivers can join the community at redcross.org. To dive into more of the programs and services provided by the American Red Cross, visit redcross.org. Thanks for checking out the Homefront Military Network Resource of the Week. If you want to hear more about the Homefront Military Network, you can find them online at homefrontmilitarynetwork.org. And if you'd like to find out more about the Family Care Center, you can find them at fcsprings.com. The Family Care Center is the Pikes Peak region's leading provider of comprehensive behavioral health for service members, veterans, and their families. They prioritize you and your family with a range of outpatient mental health services, including individual, couples, group, and family therapy, as well as medication management. Heighten your emotional wellness and receive the professional care you need from the caring and highly skilled team at the Family Care Center. So thank you for taking time to listen to the show. It would be great to hear your feedback. I'd like to answer any questions you may have or know what you would like to hear about. What topics about military and veteran mental health are you interested in? Send me an email at militarymind@fcsprings.com, and there's a chance we will discuss it on the upcoming show. I would like to remind you that the information provided on this show is for educational purposes only. While I am a mental health professional, I am not your mental health professional. If what we discussed in this episode brings up any concerns for you, it is highly recommended that you consult with your clinical mental health professional. Stay tuned for another great show next week, and until then, remember, you are not alone, ever.
This has been Inside the Military Mind, addressing mental health and wellness for service members, veterans, and their families. Sponsored by Family Care Center, Behavioral Health Services, our family caring for your family, fcsprings.com. Tune in every Saturday at 11 a.m. for Inside the Military Mind on KPPF. And listen to the companion podcast on Podbean.
Family Care Center is a comprehensive outpatient behavioral health clinic providing critical mental health support to service members, veterans, family members, and our local community. Family Care Center focuses on the mental health and wellness of those who have served our country's military by providing best-in-class evidence-based therapy, medication management, and transcranial magnetic stimulation. Family Care Center's clinical staff is dedicated to meeting every client's outpatient behavioral health care needs. This is Dr. Chuck Weber, inviting you to learn more at fcsprings.com. Family Care Center, our family caring for your family.